We've been asked to discuss our interests and experience in researching mass media and film, and it's not a bad thing to consider the history of this kind of work in the academy and the ways in which it has been spun as low culture or as legitimately academic, legitimate academic topic. Working with mass culture has a fairly long history in the American academy, but mostly through journalistic responses, like critics like the critics on the left in the 1930s and 40s who wrote about film, critics like Manny Farber, who just died recently, who was a kind of impressionist critic and influenced a lot of critics after him in presenting himself as not simply an objective critic, but someone who was experiencing the text from a particular point of view and a particular background, a particular class. In film studies in the United States, and I can only speak to film studies, I think with much authority, but I'm sure that Claire and others can correct me or give some sense of the history of television studies here. But film studies in the United States really began in language departments as a kind of art appreciation aspect of, say, American studies and literary studies. In the US 1960s and 1970s, it was possible to get gigantic packages of European art films, like the Neorealists all the way back to German Expressionism, and the earliest French films, through the Museum of Modern Art, which began to circulate these 16mm prints of these films to any institution of higher learning that wanted them. It was set around for very low prices. And so even Vanderbilt has, maybe 10 or 15, three or four real 16mm prints of films like Griffith's Intolerance and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that are left over from those days when MoMA decided it was time to kind of convince higher education that film was also an art form. It wasn't simply a low form of culture. In the 60s and 70s, when people like Gerald Mass at the University of Chicago were beginning to institutionalize film studies a little more boldly, very often the motivation for and justification for studying films at all in higher literature programs were all hinged on comparisons between film and high art, or film and Greek mythology. So if one were able to find, say, some mythological overtone of the story of Proserpine, for example, in a film like Hitchcock's The Lodger, that would legitimate one's talking about it and one's analyzing it. Whereas if we were simply to talk about it as an entertainment, it would not necessarily be worth anything to an academic to begin to analyze it and pull apart its text and determine its even its relationship to the culture. So Shakespearean connections and allusions, Greek and Roman myth, Jungian archetypes, if those things were findable in the film, then the film was worthy of legitimate study in language departments. Although there was another strain, a more American studies strain, or film studies at the same time, that seemed to appreciate films primarily for like the 1930s Depression era comedies, for example, as expressions of a kind of cultural zeitgeist. The will of the people was appearing in Frank Capra films, for example, and this was a way of thinking of what was specifically American about American art, including an American film, the kind of populist bent, and the issues of redemption that people like Leslie Fiedler were finding in American literature all the way back to novels like Edgar Huntley at the beginning of the 19th century. In radio and TV departments, communication studies began rhetoric departments began to teach radio as both a way of training radio workers and also looking at radio as something upon which to model a kind of theory of communication in an age of mass media, messages being having an intentional sender and recorded or projected receiver. And so how radio and TV worked, how they communicated, was much more, communication studies was much more on top of those issues in the way that film studies in English departments, as it was growing up in English departments, took a lot longer to get there. And so I feel in some ways as if communication studies was way into structuralism long before the rest of us. And we have people like Claire to thank for that. All of this is just to say that before the age of psychoanalysis and the use of Kant, the use of Marx and Althusser to discuss the ideological bents of film, it was very difficult for film to find legitimacy within the academy. And so there were a lot of there was a lot of dilettantism. a lot of discussion of film as if it were simply novels with pictures rather than looking deeply into the workings of the medium and how it expresses its meanings. So there come a lot of questions when one begins to approach mass culture and radio and television and film for the first time. There are two approaches that are taken to it. One is to simply dive right in and not bother to read the scholarship and not bother to learn the language that one uses to talk about film. And that leads to discussions like one I had with a graduate instructor when I was in grad school, who we were talking about, people can mix up, like dissolve sort of fades to black, and emphatically say that this dissolve is actually a fade to black, and then somebody says, no, that's the wrong term. And I said, no, it's important to get these things straight. And the graduate instructor, who was not a film teacher, said, well, you're just, an elitist, a film elitist. Anybody can talk about this stuff because we all understand film. And all I could think to say was, you wouldn't call a metaphor an allegory, right? those terms actually have a great deal of descriptive use, and they are distinct ways of changing from one shot to the next. It seems, it's worth making the distinction. On the other hand, one could, in fact, become an elitist very easily and, or become so afraid of the people who know the field really well and know the terminology of history that you are afraid to jump into the study of media at all. So, that's kind of the quagmire we often find ourselves in, caught between two cement blocks and trying to keep from being smashed between them as we try to determine, okay, do I want to reach out to the film? I know that I do want to read these texts and understand them in terms of the context of the things I'm writing about, but will I go too far or not far enough in acclimating myself to the scholarship that leads up to what it is that I'm attempting to do? So, with that background in mind, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, who's just going to say a few words about her work. Our first speaker is Claire Cisco King, received her PhD from Indiana University of Bloomington just a few years ago, and is now an assistant professor in the Communication Studies department here at Vanderbilt. She's publishing a number of pieces in communications journals in the very near future, this is very exciting, on topics ranging from masculinity and horror to masculinity and more horror. But she has a piece coming up on in Text and Performance Quarterly. Actually, this is a piece that's already been published called Acting Up and Sounding Off, Sacrificing Performativity in Alice, Sweet Alice, and has been teaching a number of courses on film horror to very great reviews from our students who are so happy that someone is teaching horror. The good news is, not only is Claire teaching horror, but she's giving them the theoretical apparatus with which to take horror apart and understand its cultural workings and significance as well. So, Claire, tell us about yourself.
Well, I like long walks on the beach and watching movies. So I came to the study of film as an English undergraduate student, and in a small school that did not have any sort of organized film studies program. English was my introduction both to cultural studies and to film studies, sort of without me realizing that I was operating in different disciplinary sort of spaces. But it became clear to me that in my study of film, I was interested in the relationship between a film text and a cultural context. And so I decided to pursue a PhD in communication and culture, which is an interdisciplinary program that incorporates the study of rhetoric with the study of performance and the study of media. So I'm interested in the ways in which popular film texts operate in relationship to and as part of larger discursive fields. So one of the things I do in my work is I sort of I like to find moments in which it becomes clear to me that there is a particular coin of the realm, right? A particular kind of language that gets spoken in a number of different spaces, right? Everything from what you might read in popular magazines like Newsweek to presidential rhetoric to the rhetoric of popular film and television. And then I'm interested in and in how this kind of what I would call an organizing discourse offers a lens for mapping a number of different questions about identity, including national identity, masculinity, sexuality, things like that. So if one of the angsty issues that film studies has in its history is the question between high art and low trash, I want to push that barrier even further and only study the low of the low in films, because I'm interested in the ways in which films that are typically written off by critics, disaster films, horror films, the ones that are written off by our students, by our friends as mere entertainment, just a movie, the ways in which these films are deeply invested in prevailing American discourses and are not just speaking them, but are helping to reinstitute them, right, helping to reinscribe them. So to kind of specify what I mean by all this, at the moment, my research is focusing on the discourse of trauma as something that I'm identifying as a particularly valent discourse in American culture at this point, right? The language of injury, what some people call wound culture, the investment in understanding how people as individuals, but also social bodies as collectives, could be wounded by a particular event and in need of recovery, right? So, of course, 9/11 is probably something that pops to mind as an example of the animation of trauma discourse. And so in response to, or as part of that process, I looked to films that seemed to use the language, the lexicon of trauma, in order to make sense of, to reconstitute, and to manage history in certain ways, right? So, for instance, I looked at the film Poseidon, which is a disaster film, a disaster of a disaster film, released in 2006, in which you can point to the sort of the iconography of 9/11 is this kind of, you know, event in giant brackets at work in this film, and this logic of this sort of quintessential American logic of redemption as part of the narrative of the film that comes to manage this kind of historical problematic. Now, in doing this kind of work, of course, one of the problematics I run into is trying to make that connection to culture, right? How does one claim that a text is in fact speaking and being spoken by its culture? So one of the things that I love about a film like Poseidon is that it's a remake. Poseidon is a 2006 remake of a 1972 film. And I'm interested in that idea of the remake as a kind of a cultural phenomenon. And of course, the easy answer, in trying to understand why does a film get remade is to say, well, because it's easier, it's cheaper, it's efficient, right? We can quite simply, I think, or quickly turn to kind of industry rationales, economic rationale for why films get remade. But for me, that doesn't answer the question of, sure, I understand the principle of the remake at that level, but it doesn't tell me why this film and why this film now, right? So that's one of my guiding questions. Why this film and why this film now? And why in this way? So, you know, the work that I have to do is in connecting this film to its larger kind of discursive surround. And for me, that gets done, my method for doing that is to do really sort of specific textual analysis, so that I can look to the specific kind of the composition of images, I can look to the level of sort of narrative lines of action, I can look to levels of dialogue to find ways in which there is a kind of a constancy or a continuity between what is being proffered by the text and what is being proffered in the cultural context, right? So that I can suggest it's more than just mere accident, right, that a film like Poseidon gets remade at this moment, in relationship to the larger historical context, right? That there is an actual symbiotic and productive relationship being offered. But I offer those claims sometimes to looks of confusion, and people should say, how can you connect culture to film? And I say, well, how can you not, right?
Good start. Thank you very much. Our next speaker, I'm very pleased to introduced Danica Loss. Danica received her MFA in writing from the University of Texas at Austin and is currently a first-year graduate student in the English department here, and she's interested in the reiterations and failures of the cowboy in popular literature. So, Danica?
As Paul said, I'm interested in sort of these sort of recurring images of the cowboy, not only in sort of contemporary American literature, but also in popular media, which for me includes print ads and commercials and maybe looking back to like radio programs and sort of television and film. And sort of the failure of this image to, that is supposed to function, I think, I have an idea at this point, like it's really early in the process, obviously, but that the cowboy is supposed to sort of function as a symbol of America, but I think it mostly fails at that level of representation. I think that the symbolic cowboy can only exist sort of in the fantasy worlds of film and advertisement and TV and sort of reimagining the West and how the West might function. Like I'm thinking like Cormac McCarthy's like Border Trilogy and sort of this romanticizing of the cowboy and that way of life, which seems sort of very isolated and lonely. So because I'm interested, like I'm just like when I see the cowboy, I'm like, whoa, what is he doing here? Like, where did he come from? Because it's not real cowboys. It tends to be sort of this fantasy cowboy. So I haven't, like, as far as doing, like, film stuff or, like, training and other things, I haven't, up to this point, had very much exposure to that. I took a course where we did talk about film and literature at UT, and took a print culture class where we talked about ways of thinking of popular culture and popular sort of like material culture circulating in a society and like production and distribution, intended audience and reception, and trying to figure out how to gauge those things. But I'm not always sure how one might apply those things. And last semester I wrote a paper, and part of it dealt with a commercial it was a Coke commercial that ran during the 2008 Olympics, and it was this really weird computer-generated scene between Yao Ming and LeBron James. And the commercial is like completely insane, it's just like a mess of symbols, it's like of cultural symbols that are just really stereotypical, I will actually just read you something from the actual like press release about this commercial. The first new Coca-Cola ad features Olympians Yao Ming and LeBron James engaging in a friendly animated face-off. Backed by two troops of choreographed icons representing their respective cultures, the spot celebrates the athletes' competitive spirit and cultural diversity while showcasing Coca-Cola as a unifying force and universal icon that belongs to everyone. And in this commercial, it's really ridiculous.
I'm just shocked by the fact that commercials have
commercials
have press releases.
Have press releases, all of them.
And this was on the Coca-Cola site, like just on the Coca-Cola website. And in the commercial, Yao Ming and LeBron James are facing off in computer-generated images, and LeBron James sort of draws from his hip and pulls up this cowboy, like this like white cowboy wearing a black hat who's taller than LeBron James. And LeBron James is like 6'7", like 250 pounds, and this cowboy is enormous. And I thought, well, that's weird, because sitting with my sister, it's really bizarre. So, like, I guess, like, I'm sort of, like, looking at moments that are happening now and trying to figure out, like, why would, it doesn't make sense to me that LeBron James would say, okay, I know my symbol of America would be the cowboy. Like, there seems to be some dissonance there and the failure of this actually happened in real life, that this cowboy, I don't think, actually exists. Like, I don't know what kind of horse he would ride. Being entirely larger than LeBron James.
Kind of why this icon and why this icon now? So you can be driving questions to compare to Claire's questions.
Mm-hmm. And so for that, like, I like read through the class, like, some Homi Bhabha, and he had this notion that the nations are necessarily heterogeneous, and phrases like the people represent this idealized homogenous group, but it can't include all the possible people. And I figured this could also apply to something like a national symbol, like the cowboy, at least like in how it fails to function. So anyway, I guess I'm still trying to figure out the methodology part. And I'm not exactly sure how that analysis of the commercial went. So I feel like I'm really early in this, but I'm really interested in how these images are functioning and sort of talking to each other and how they may speak to sort of like images of the Marvel Man and like, who's no longer around.
Because he died of cancer.
Just like a side note, in that same paper with the LeBron James commercial, I also talked about Brokeback Mountain, and there was an op-ed piece written shortly after Brokeback Mountain came out. And this, I can't remember the guy's name, he was like, this is the rape of the Marlboro Man. Like, that's how he's, like, it was such an attack to him, like, on this national symbol that he just couldn't, like, he was flabbergasted and very frustrated. I thought, whoa, mysterious reaction. But that he sees that, like, the cowboy functioning as a national symbol and, like, it's sort of being attacked. But yet, it also, like, the cowboy in Brokeback Mountain fails, like, can only exist in this isolated place, or, like, that particular reiteration of the cowboy, you know, like,
So I don't know exactly what I'm doing. That's what I'm saying.
All right, thank you very much. And our last presenter is, yeah, I think I know where you are. Where's my notes? This has been a very busy Friday for the English department because of the graduates, prospective graduate students visiting today, so it's a little nutty. Nafisa Thompson Spires is a fifth year PhD student in the English department, and her dissertation project is called Maple and My Syrup, Cheese and My Poutine, Canadian Youth Television in the United States, and she's published two snippets of it in FLO, an online journal for television studies, and is getting very close to finishing her dissertation, which is coming along swimmingly. So Nafisa, take it away.
All right, so obviously the medium of my research is television, and I'm studying it in ways that sound pretty similar to what Claire and Denise are doing, where commercials and the cultural context sort of become the most interesting to me. I'm thinking a lot about individual series and individual television series, episodes, and I'm thinking of them as texts, but framing them always sort of comes from the cultural context. How is this being produced, and how is it working within national mythology? So since I work with Canadian television, it's a very, very loaded issue already. Canadian television is both public and private, and it began as sort of a governmental institution, as a state monopoly. So there's these very, very strict rules about how much national identity it has to represent. They have actual quotas for national content, and series get rated and marked based on how much of Canada they seem to represent. But then that runs counter to all of this discourse about how there's no such thing as Canadian identity, which is like their framing narrative. We have no identity. We don't know what it means to be Canadian. All we know is that we're not American and that they suck and they're always bothering us and we have to protect ourselves from them. So the TV has to be really culturally representative, and yet they don't know what the culture is. So I'm trying to pull all of that together into a narrative about how much Canadian television has served U.S. television over the years, and I'm thinking specifically about youth television and television produced between 1979 and 2009. And I chose those dates because that's when Degrassi started and that's when it's supposed to end, and Degrassi's a really important show within this, but also it seems like a good swath of time because multiculturalism's coming in the early 70s, all of these things are changing over where the television gets distributed within this time period, so it's working okay, I think. But what I'm really trying to argue is that Canadian television has been completely central to U.S. television's mythology and U.S. television's development, particularly in youth television. And that Canada works as both an arbiter of U.S. culture and a mediator between the United States and other countries. So all of these series that we seem to think are American are often filmed in Canada. They're completely Canadian sometimes, and there's a difference between being filmed in Canada and being Canadian. Being Canadian means you have like national symbols that are obvious, but being filmed in Canada means you could be trying to hide that fact and pass it off for California. So there's all these differences. There's like five different ways that a show could be Canadian, but it's not really Canadian for four of those ways. So I'm thinking about all of those kinds of shows and trying to figure out what a Canadian aesthetic might be, and then also how we can trace that aesthetic in shows that make it to the United States and that are really, really popular here, and yet often not even noticed as being Canadian. So I'm basically writing a history of that time period and how Canadian products function within it. Methodologically, I think my method is trial and error because I was an English major undergrad, and I didn't really do too much with media studies then. And then the work that I've done here as a graduate student has I was an early Americanist when I started out, which is about as far from what I'm doing as you can be.
You followed your dream.
I did. I came in with an idea about Canada, but I was like, no, let me put that away. And then I tried to do the other stuff, but I just couldn't. The Canadian stuff wouldn't die. So I did an independent study where I got to study a lot of media and media theory and television theory specifically. And I found all of that was really helpful. But I think that my method really is to work on television in a literary way. I still end up relying on close reading. I still end up using a lot of theory, like post-colonial theory and stuff that comes from my discipline, but I'm just not studying texts that readily fit with my discipline. So I find that that works pretty well. I still need to borrow things from other fields, but I still feel like ultimately I'm rooted in the English department and in literary studies. That's kind of it.
Thank you. Since we're, I guess we're not running out of time, but we did start a little late, would you like to talk about your clip?
Sure. Well, the clip, I have to set it up a little bit, but it's kind of a long story too. The clip I'm dealing with comes from the network. The clip I'm dealing with is from The Inn, which is a network. It's called Noggin. It used to be called Noggin, and now it's called The Inn. They divided it into two. It's a Viacom-owned channel, and it's sort of in between Nickelodeon and MTV. It's the TV network. The Inn started in 2001, and they've been broadcasting Degrassi since they started. And Degrassi's been, like, their only show that gets high ratings, aside from another Canadian show. And they've been censoring it since it first came out on the network. And the Canadian network that airs it, CTV, which is a regular network channel, it's not a digital or a pay channel, it's just like ABC, never censors it, and it never does anything strange to the broadcast. So I've been thinking about how The Inn is trying to sort of figure out what the boundaries of Americanness are in the ways that it rewrites Degrassi, and it's rewritten it in so many different ways. But the most famous one is an abortion episode that occurred in 2004. It's a two-part story arc, where The Inn refused to show these episodes because they thought that abortion and teens just don't really go together in the U.S. And even though there have been plenty of abortion plots in television, if you really look at them, and teen television in particular, nobody has an abortion. They think about it, the baby dies before they get there, something happens, but they never have an abortion. So it was a really big deal that this girl actually had one. And that's part of why they refused to show the episode. In the 80s, PBS did the same thing with Degrassi High, where they censored the episode. They didn't refuse to show it, but they re-edited it so that you couldn't tell whether or not the girl had an abortion. But if you watched the next episode, it was pretty clear that she did. So it was weird. But this channel just downright refused to show it. And it had a pretty big public backlash in that there were all these petitions, and it was in Entertainment Weekly, it was in the LA Times, New York Times, London, all kinds of press. So they censored all this stuff, and then they decided to bring it all back later and say, like, look, you didn't know that we never showed you this before. So we're going to show it to you now, because now we're a cool network. Before we were like this other kind of network, but now we're really cool. So they decided to show the abortion episode and to show all these other episodes that nobody knew they had censored, except for, like, hardcore fans who were paying attention and comparing notes with Canadians who were watching it unedited. So they also censored an episode where a guy has an erection at school. And it's clothed, I mean, it's not nude. I have to explain that because in other talks, people are like, it was naked, you can't show nudity, that's why they censored it, but he's perfectly clothed. So they brought this back, and they have all these commercials advertising, like, how we're going to show you this clover, which is what they called it. And I wanted to show you the commercials. That's what my clip is.
So don't pay attention to Ricky and Brian Krakow of My So-Called Life, because the commercial's appearing during My So-Called Life. There's a banner at the bottom. That's what you're supposed to pay attention to. And then it comes on in a full commercial after that.
Hi. Ow, what? Stop. Oh, you know what. So, Sharon Jersky told me that Delia has it for you. Has it for me? What? That's like an expression people say, right?
Originally said, like, this doesn't go with our boundaries. We can't show this kind of stuff in the United States. And then when they wanted to rebrand and change their boundaries, they're like, look, we're going to show you all this stuff as it was meant to be seen. And what I'm thinking about is how what often gets labeled as national guidelines, like Disney is a very American network, we don't do this, but Canada does this stuff. How those things actually end up being based on market forces and not at all on what really means to be Canadian or American, what kids are really allowed to do in the country. So I use a lot of commercials to do my argument, and not just the shows themselves.
Great, thank you. I'm actually not going to take up
any time with specifically talking about my issues, except as part of the conversation as we go forward. So we really imagine this as a roundtable, and of course we've given more formal presentations now, but we like to open this up to a larger room-wide conversation. But I am going to try to keep things going with a few questions. And one thing I wanted to ask Danica in particular is, what's the most difficult aspect of approaching audiovisual material as a text, something that can be analyzed, something that can be read for you, since your background is primarily in English, where you're reading a certain kind of text, which has no audiovisual content?
Right. Well, I guess the difficult part is just finding the right language. I have some sort of introductory film books that sort of the technical terms and stuff, but just feeling I'm sort of saying things the way that they're supposed to be. So that sort of seems to be, because I feel like I can read the commercials, or the film, I feel like I can say, okay, this is what's happening in the scene, but it's just being able to talk about it in a way that sort of is clear and sort of respects the medium has been, I'm still trying to but sometimes too, I do worry, and I don't know if this isn't necessarily an answer to a particular question, but in studying film, that seems more acceptable maybe than talking about commercials, just sort of on their own, and not necessarily related to a TV show, which is this weird Coke ad, or there's some weird John Deere commercial sort of floating around. It's how to justify for myself, I guess, how these are sort of things that sort of deserve to be looked at. I don't know, I feel like maybe I just need to work through that, and it's already been established somewhere else, and it's totally fine. But I don't know, I feel like maybe film studies got over that hump, that it's kind of cool to study film, but maybe with the other stuff it's a little more.
No, it's a great. I mean, it's a great way to set things up, and it's also a question that a lot of us ask. I think it's one of the reasons why I wish there were more crosstalk between film studies as a discipline and communication studies as a discipline. Communication studies has never been afraid to talk about commercials as cultural documents. Could you say a little bit about how that works in communication studies? How the ad is approached?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the typical. Advertising is a really sort of popular kind of genre, I guess, for communication scholars, for rhetoricians, because rhetoricians are interested in, what we call rhetorical situations, right, which is when you have some sort of exigency, and you have a sort of a speaker and an imagined audience, and that speaker is trying to persuade an audience to act in a particular way in response to this situation. And so advertising is, of all the sort of, audiovisual media, I think the one that is most unabashedly persuasive, right? I mean, advertisements are trying to get us to react in a certain way. And so I think that it's been easier for rhetoricians to study advertisements because they were so clearly invested in the sort of rhetorical impulse. And I think that, so someone like Bart has always been really influential in those kinds of conversations. And there's a rhetorical scholar, Kenneth Burke, who he started as a literary critic and became a rhetorician with, and one of the sort of important pieces that gets cited is his essay where he talks about literature as equipment for living. And so advertising is often kind of couched in that terminology, which is to say that ads, sort of name situations for us, literally products, and they command our expectations, and they encourage certain kinds, or they invite certain kinds of responses. So I think it's been the clearly effective potential of advertisements to persuade, right, to move people to act in certain ways, that's been the justification for their study in communication. And it's interesting because I feel like communication studies is, in many ways, has been more comfortable talking about ads as text to be read in close ways than about film until recently, because I think a lot of what communication studies did, throughout the 80s in terms of film was do this mythic analysis and was, interested in the way that films speak to these larger kind of more established traditions. And it's really only, I would say, been in the last 10 or so years that I feel like communication studies as a field has sort of embraced the study of the film text as a text in itself, you know, whether or not it speaks to these grander traditions.
Do you think that the reason, Claire, that film and maybe even television shows were less tasty for communications theorists to begin with was because they're fictional, as opposed to, like, an ad could be said to be fictional, but it's it's rhetorical. It has a kind of rhetorical dominant that might cancel out the fictionality of it in terms of the importance of what the viewer is going to get out of the ad. Whereas a television show, a soap opera, soap operas have been fodder for communications theorists and cultural studies people for a long time for good reason. But I get the feeling that it was a little more of a slow start toward fictional texts and television even for communication studies as opposed to ads and like news analysis, for example.
Well, and I think that has a lot to do with, a couple of things. One is this idea of the rhetorical situation as one being, one in which an argument is being presented, because I think a lot of people don't think about television shows and films as making arguments. I do think they make arguments, but they don't make them in any way that's necessarily explicit. So it's harder to identify that kind of persuasive work. And I think the other issue is what you talked about is the sort of early models for communication being these transmission models, right? When we think about a sender or a speaker and a receiver. And it's easier, I think, just to sort of intuitively identify those positions in a commercial, right? You can at least think about the product itself or its manufacturer as having a clear sort of intentionality. But it's harder to identify that kind of the speaker in a film text, right? Is it the director? Is it the screenwriter? Is it the writer? And of course, now communication studies has abandoned that sender-receiver model is utterly flawed and not all that useful. But I think that probably had something to do with the slow start as well.
It's interesting that you bring up Bard, because both English studies, literary studies in general, and film studies, especially in France and England, picked up on Bard immediately as the way that they picked up on Saussure and structuralism, structural linguistics, as a way of thinking about texts as encodings of other kinds of intentional messages. So, but it's interesting that, in a way, there's a kind of ships passing in the night issue here, that Bard was accepted in literary and aesthetic studies as a way of explaining how narration works in, say, film or television, and we're thinking of the narrator, the invisible narrator, or the ideal narrator, as someone or something that is speaking to an ideal subject position or an ideal spectator, whereas that model didn't have much relevance in terms of fiction in communication studies, but it was very useful for fleshing out the communication sender, mediator, receiver model, and yet the kinds of texts that were being discussed in each of these fields were very, very different texts.
Well, and Bard is now having a sort of another heyday in communication studies as part of what's being called the subfield of visual rhetoric, right? Which is, as its title suggests, the study of rhetoric in visual texts. But this is understood in distinction to the rhetorical criticism of television and film. And so visual rhetoric is looking primarily at sort of like photojournalistic images, iconic photography, things like that, as being somehow distinct from media criticism, which I haven't quite parsed out why I think that division's happening, but it's a new trend.
Nafisa, what did you come up against when you were, you started out thinking about, I know you were writing and thinking about Degrassi and television before this, but when you took my graduate seminar in the early seminar, and then came upon wanting to push harder on your longstanding interest in Degrassi and kind of critique it and analyze it. What kinds of leaps do you feel there had to be made between a kind of film studies approach and a television studies approach that maybe you didn't expect? Or what kinds of things did you have to account for in talking about television and text that you didn't have to worry about when talking about film?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Some of the formal things are similar, non-diegetics, they're always going to mean the same thing in film and television, but television still has its own language, like what's actually going on and the mechanics of it. So I had to learn those terms, and I have to admit that I didn't pay as much attention to them in thinking about film as I should have, so I had to sort of review what those things meant to talk about television. But then the other thing is that I feel like even though film is still considered a low art form in the weird literary pot pie thing,
Television is like the lowest of the low, kind of like the bad horror movies. I mean, there's no such thing as avant-garde television to people. And even if there is such a thing as that, it's still really, really low down. So you have to sort of justify it in a different way than you can something that's established like film, especially in an English department. I don't feel like they would have had to do that so much in a communications studies program. It's already got a tradition of studying these kinds of things. But I feel like television, it's still considered to be like a strange thing to study. Or a strange thing to study, particularly from a literary standpoint. So that was another thing that I had to sort of figure out. And what I found is it does have its own, I mean, a full-scale tradition of ways of writing about it, but they're just very different from the way that we tend to write about things in English. Like, television studies, the kind of television studies I was coming up against tended towards the empirical. And so when I would try to send something off to a journal that was for television, it didn't fit with the kind of methodology that they had. They wanted me to think about the actual numbers and audience reception in different ways than what I was thinking about. So even if I could speak the language, I was thinking about it in a completely different way from my real television studies people were so there are all these divisions, and it's like you have to kind of figure out where you can fit within it. And what I find is I think I do something closer to cultural studies than communication studies.
Right. So, yeah. I found, you know, when sort of trying to figure out my way as a graduate student between, you know, what television studies does differently from film studies, I kept coming up against, problems like, you know, what Raymond Williams commonly famously called flow, the fact that television just, you know, continually runs on and on and on and is always sort of pointing us ahead in a way that is a little bit different from the way that Hollywood film points us ahead to the ending. Mm-hmm. Television is pointing us ahead to the next episode or to the show that comes after this show. It's like, you know, there's a kind of intertextuality that's happening all the time between the commercial breaks and the fact
that
the next
show.
We're even seeing multiple windows in the same image where the same image is, you know, sending different signals to us simultaneously. So we have to multitask almost as much as when we're, you know, manipulating multiple windows on the computer screen. But it seemed as though those distinctions are really, they're media distinctions, but they need not necessarily be disciplinary distinctions. It's just sometimes difficult to find the audience that will, you know, both sympathize with your sense of television as a cultural document that tells us some very important things about the way we construct things like Americanness versus Canadianness, for example. And but doesn't necessarily want to hear or read about that or understand it in terms of figures like Nielsen ratings, for example, the more kind of sociological aspect of some approaches to television studies. So, you know, just trying to figure one's way out around the disciplines when you're first starting out is not easy. You know, reading a lot of journals and trying to figure out exactly how they pitch their work is a good place to start, but you know, it's not easy to know where to go from there sometimes.
I guess this is coming off what you were all talking about. My question is about how you're all dealing with perception. Because I know this has been dealing a lot with fandom and had to negotiate those terms herself and sort of the ideal perceiver and sort of the objective read communication studies, but in a way, like having it happen in culture has like people who receive it and sort of the actual reaction that happened to it. And I was interested in the way you were all dealing with
I deal with it by not dealing with it, which, you know, by saying, but I don't do reception studies, I let these people do that. I deal with reception at the level of critical discourse about a film, so I often include the kind of talk that reviewers offer up of a film, which is clearly very different from the kind of reception work that's done, you know, in terms of audience ethnography, that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm interested in what critics have to say, because for me it participates again in the sort of the sense of public culture, public discourse, right? And again, it's about sort of naming the, you know, situations and commanding these expectations. So, in terms of the reception issue, I just apologize for not doing it and ask people to turn to the people who do it.
There's a way of approaching reception in the kind of apparatus theory tradition of film studies where reception, any discussion of reception is all about what the film ideally, the kind of spectator the film ideally constructs, and then the post-structuralist reaction to that is, you know, what happens when other kinds of spectators, like, you know, a queer, like gay spectator, watching a film that's, you know, seems to
produce as Laura Mulvey would say, a heterosexual male gaze, what kind of reaction would, you know, might a woman have, what kind of stresses might a woman or a gay man have in, you know, understanding that film, what kind of strains against, what kinds of strains between his or her subject position and the one that the film is positing might be. But that's all very much in the realm of textuality. We're thinking about the kinds of expectations that are produced by the text, and in a way we're talking about a kind of negative shape of a spectator rather than any actual spectator. And so when Janet Steiger comes along and does actual reception studies, like, you know, how people talked about and wrote about and sent fan letters to someone like, Clara Bow, or, but who am I thinking of, the A Fool There Was, the first vamp in Hollywood.
Yeah.
First word sounds like Theda Bar. Yeah. Yeah, right. You know, she's actually doing close reception studies of what kinds of, you know, poems they wrote about, you know, these stars, and trying to come up with, you know, claims that would be impossible for someone who's simply doing subject position studies to do. And yet I feel like reception studies are outside of what I am trained in doing and really capable of doing, because I'm trained as a, you know, as a textual interpreter and an analyst. And, so, you know, while I'm very adamant that, yes, you know, you have to talk about the visuals, the audio of a film in order to really understand it, you can't talk about a film as if it were simply like an illustrated novel and not talk about framing and to have a language and visual possibilities of cinema and oral possibilities, also shape, and, you know, shape the text and how it's sending its messages. I just don't feel comfortable stepping too far into the realm of actual spectatorship, which means that the spectators I'm talking about are still perhaps, you know, hanging out in platonic heaven with all the perfect triangles and stuff, rather than actual, you know, beings who walk the earth. But I feel some discomfort about that sometimes. And then, like Claire, I ignore it.
Yeah. No, and it's about rhetorical games, too. You know, I mean, it's about saying that the text encourages spectators to react this way, invites us to, you know, wants to position us this way without actually assuming that it necessarily succeeds in doing that.
Right, and I think that's still an important tendency to try to track. Mm-hmm. It sometimes gets left out, you know, the tension between what text suggests and what, how we might actually react or how we might actually read it. I think it's still an important tension.
Absolutely. This is something like lightning. The way that show works is now we all look around, well, he's lying. I should know that he is, you know. That is, it's all about training your audience so you look in exactly the way that show anticipates, and then playing on that with screen within screen within screen. And then what made me think about that, though, is with this commercial, right, is what they did in the first couple episodes of Lie to Me is they segued immediately into news stories about people. And the ads for it was, is this person lying? You know, and they show it and go, I've just been watching a show about that. I know. That's, those ears say lie. You know, I mean, yeah, it was a politician that should have given them himself, but now I can scientize it.
Right, I've been told by a fictional television show how to understand lying and read it off of, you know, phrenological heads or whatever. So
it's now you kind of loop to the very question. Reception here, because I mean, it's a show that's ultimately about that. So everyone's acting.
I guess I use reception to think about the failures of something. So I can figure out what the narrative is trying to do, the argument it's trying to make, and I like to go back to the viewers. And I mean, the fans of these shows are crazy. I mean, they're writing pages and pages and pages and pages all day. They're writing while they're watching it, if you look at the time that they've posted. So, I like to think about when the narrative failed to do what it was trying to do and when the audience didn't buy it. So one thing that really bothers me about a lot of Canadian television is the way that it approaches multiculturalism. Like, it has this really superficial form of multiculturalism where they have a lot of people of different colors and that's multicultural, but they all have really horrible things happen to them in a way that says, we don't really want you here. And I like to think about what the fans say about these things. And often they get off on all kinds of tangents where they get into arguments with each other about stuff. That's one interesting thing. And then also, most of the shows I'm dealing with are really didactic, and they're like trying to teach a kid a lesson. So I like to think about when they learn the wrong lesson from it. And this is a fun thing to teach, because one time I was talking to my students about an episode of Degrassi that warned you against STDs and oral sex and how you can get gonorrhea, I think it was. And my students thought this was really hilarious, but then they told me that they learned a lot of bad things from television that was trying to teach them how not to do bad things. So, like, one girl yelled out, Seventh Heaven taught me how to huff, and I didn't even know what huffing was, and I was like, me too! There was an episode of Seventh Heaven where these kids were, like, snorting spray paint or something, and they get really high off of it, and we just thought that was crazy. But I never knew such a thing existed until Seventh Heaven told me that kids were doing it and that it was really horrible. And that's what my students were saying. And so I like to go to the message boards and see when the viewers are like, yeah, I tried to teach us not to sexualize this woman, but look at the picture I've got on my message. And it's like the same woman from the show who was half naked in an episodic lesson, and they're posting this naked picture of her over and over to say, like, look, this is a really cute picture of her, isn't it? And so they're completely and purposely missing the lessons, but they know what the lessons are. And so I'm not really writing too much about this anymore, but it's something that's fun to think about when you're dealing with kids' stuff.
How does pleasure come into play? Because when each of you were talking and you're dealing with, and we started out talking about how we look at films, television, commercials as entertainment, and you all clearly have fun doing what you do. What role does pleasure play in how you write, and maybe in the culture of the academy? It seems like for a while, it was not cool to talk about something that was pleasurable. But do you think that it's changing or maybe not?
That's a great question. My students ask me all the time when I teach intro media classes if what I do ruins movies for me, because they assume that thinking critically about a text somehow takes the pleasure away, right? And my answer to them is, well, I mean, for me, taking apart a text is the pleasure, right? I mean, it's what I find to be it's what I find to be fun. So right, so one part of the pleasure for me is just the actual process. You know, I like looking at a text and thinking about the different ways I can position, you know, Kurt Russell as an icon or a signifier or something, right? And when I'm writing, especially when I'm doing conference stuff and I'm actually having conversations with people or reading, I like to bring pleasure into the sort of my own play with language, right, when I'm writing. So that there is actual, you know, for me, fun in the text itself. But I also think the other dimension of pleasure to be taken seriously is the kind of pleasure that audiences have when they watch these movies, right? And how when you take something like a disaster film that's marketed almost entirely as being about a peculiar kind of pleasure, but pleasure nonetheless, that we have to take seriously the fun that people have with movies and how that positions them to be receptive or not to be receptive in certain ways. I don't know. I think pleasure's back in the academy. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to have fun with what you do. It's not I'm in trouble, but.
Danica, you have any thoughts about that?
I feel like sometimes I get really excited about the cowboy thing because, like, I haven't really watched a lot of westerns, but like watching westerns sort of post like Brokeback, like they're just really explicitly like we love each other, and I'm like yes. But I feel like when I'm writing about it, like I really have to scale back that excitement because it does feel a little overwhelming sometimes. It just seems really weird.
You expressed, it seems to be a lot of pleasure in your annoyance, in a way, at the commercial you described.
Because it's all, like, yeah, because it's all the time. I'm saying that with my sister, and she's like, what? I'm like, LeBron James, a cowboy. LeBron James, a cowboy. Like that, like going back and forth, and she's like, that is weird. I'm like, I know, this is like really kind of awesome. And, it's really nice to sort of see like those sort of, like when things really fail to cohere. But I have actually had like films ruined for me, like in writing about them. Like, I think I wrote about Kill Bill Volume 1, and by the end of it, I was like I love the movie, I love the film before. And by the time I was done, I was like, now I see what he's doing, and I don't like it. Like, so, but I did hope that, like, I mean, it's nice having the opportunity to, and having people be excited about what I want to work on. Like, when I say cowboys, you know, like, people aren't like, so, I mean, I feel like I've had a lot of support, like, even just, like, this year, just mentioning it.
I'm here, so. Lafisa, I guess your pleasure in Degrassi was kind of a subtext of the entire first year that we spent talking about this project.
And unlike Claire, I feel like it dies a lot over time. I mean, thinking critically for a long time about things that you initially really loved kind of take something out of it. I still love it, but I love it in a way that feels like I have to go back to a certain place to love it because it's so hard when you know what's going on and what's wrong about it. That's one thing I'm grappling with, I guess I can share. I not only like what I'm doing, but I like the people who work on what I'm doing. So I really like the producers of Degrassi because they're so nice and they'll give you information and stuff. So when I find something that really bothers me about the show, I almost feel guilty when I want to write about how there's a racist undercurrent in this or that. I actually feel like this person will get mad at me if I write this because this person was nice to me when I tried to interview him or that kind of thing. And so that's a way in which I feel like the pleasure gets interrupted. But the texts themselves are still fun. But what I do find is that it's hard to watch anything on television that's just to veg out or just watch it for entertainment purposes because, and Derek can talk about this too, we watch TV so together when it's both of us, we are so like spiteful in things that we say about things that we can't just watch something for fun anymore. It's always like, did you see what that man did? Why is the black man off in the frame like that? Why is this going on? And so it does, it gets really hard to turn it off. And I found that I do have to turn off that part of myself or I can't watch anything.
Yeah, that's where I am. You know, I'm like if I'm tearing something apart, you know, loving it, hating it, I'm having fun in that.
The MST3K aesthetic. You know, like, I'm liking the robots down in the corner, and we're loving tearing this piece.
Yeah. And I don't like Kurt Russell, so I don't care if I hear this week. Like that helps.
You know, Laura Mulvey's essay "Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema," which she published in 1975, comes out as this kind of payoff against pleasure. At least that's how it's often read. You know, what she wanted to do was dismantle the pleasure that we take as spectators in watching classical Hollywood narratives because all the pleasures are gendered male and we may not even realize it, that they know there's work watching dominance and submission at work between masculinity and femininity and enjoying it. But it, actually what you know she says at several key points in the essay is that she wants to create, you know, she wants to come up with some other kind of pleasure that would work in a different register. So she was also a filmmaker and experimented with like making films like Scribbles of the Sphinx, where the camera just goes 360 degrees for each shot as a way of de-hierarchizing the image and de-hierarchizing the way that the narrative unfolded. So you know, ever since that point, I think you know there's been a great deal of thought about pleasure in and probably before this as well, but there's when pleasure, destruction of pleasure as a radical weapon, as she called it, became a kind of calling point for feminist film theory. I think it was then, you know, 10 years later or 5 years later, it became kind of a radical claim to say, let's put pleasure back into this, even though I don't think Mulvey would have necessarily considered it all that outre. When I think about the way that I teach my students, I sometimes get a bit embarrassed about this when I try to get them not to evaluate. I want them to think analytically. It's like, do you like the film? Do you hate the film? I don't care. That's not what we're doing in this class. You can do that in some other class, or you know, we can talk about, I can teach a criticism class, and we can write nothing but kind of journalistic criticism and talk about liking or hating. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I find myself saying, I really, really like this film, and sort of bringing it back. I wonder if perhaps it's a kind of conscious attempt on my part to both get them to think critically but take pleasure in the criticism, the act of analysis itself, because I have the same answer for my students when they say, doesn't this ruin it for you? I think, no, I mean, you know, analyzing text is its own pleasure, but it's a pleasure that moves alongside things like waiting for the big climactic ending.
That's a subtle way of saying yes.
Yeah,
actually.
Do you think so?
Yeah, because what you're doing and you're saying, yes, your viewing is ruined. I, however, have a particular kind of viewing, which is, it's really a different sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the slide to claim that it's somehow the same thing,
mm-hmm.
and that therefore the pleasure in that is preserving that pleasure, you know, I mean, I would give a sort of more radical answer. Yeah, I like criticizing texts, and I like watching them done with it too. And I can do both at the same
absolutely,
time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and yeah, I'm good at being dumb, actually, in one of my strong points. This is the first time, because I've used that answer too, because of course you get that, talking about poetry, talking about any text. And this is the first time I've realized, as you were saying, that there's kind of
there's some business.
Power move, and the problem with that as an answer to students.
Mm-hmm. Right, because
you're saying,
it kind of breaks the other end.
Yes,
yeah.
Here's a real pleasure. You know, your pleasure is false consciousness.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, termite culture pleasure.
That's a very good point. I mean, it's something to try to kind of adjudicate without making students feel as though their pleasure is illegitimate, because it's one of the reasons why they take film courses.
Yeah.
It's not something they're going to analyze. It's because they love film and they want to take other views of it to understand something more about how what directors do, or you know, how screenplays can get adapted in various ways by different filmmakers. And you know, sometimes they really love it, and other times they're just kind of puzzled by it. You know, they shouldn't, I think, in the end, feel as though their pleasure is the illegitimate, because our analytical pleasure is more supple than ours or something.
Well, and I think that the simultaneity of it is so important. I spoke to a group of students yesterday about how I do what I do, and I was talking to them about the film Armageddon, which I just had to return to finish up some revisions on something. And I can't stand the film Armageddon, right? Armageddon is a terrible movie, I think, by any standards. And
even Michael
and,
Bay standards.
Right. And I'm sitting here, I'm like taking my notes and being like actively analytical when I'm watching this film. And I was also crying at one point, right, because of the absurd love story between Ben Affleck and Liv Tyler, and Can't They Just Be Together? And I was so struck by the absurdity of the, you know, the coexistence of these two things, but it was absolutely at once. And I was having this sort of pleasure in the abandon, and like I turned it into my own body genre movie, and at the same time was doing the, you know, and you're right, they happen at the same time, sometimes in contradiction with
right,
each other, but they're still there together.
There was a Robin Wood famously said that you probably would never believe that a middle-aged male academic would burst into tears every time he hears Doris Day begin to sing Que Sera, Sera in The Man Who Knew Too Much, but this one does. and yet it's an analytical essay about the American family as this kind of patriarchal, you know, cage in that film. So, but he manages, like few critics I know, to sort of always be analyzing his own pleasure and his own reactions as one of the ways in which he expresses the kinds of analysis he's doing on a more general, larger, ideological or generic scale or whatever. So I admire his honesty.
He luxuriates in his own symptoms.
Oh yeah. Enjoy your symptom. Well, it's about a quarter after, so this has been great. I've really enjoyed talking with you folks and talking with you. I appreciate it.